Welcome back, everybody. Ready for another deep dive?
Always am.
Okay, great. Today, we're tackling some excerpts from a lecture all about the Book of Samuel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is. And specifically, you know, kind of focusing on the life of Samuel himself and how Israel, kind of surprisingly, you know, goes from this system of judges to having a king.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a really fascinating transition in Israel's history because it represents, I think, a pretty big shift in how they understood their relationship with God and with leadership.
Exactly. Yeah. It kind of makes you think about, you know, what were they hoping for with a king? What were they seeing around them that made them think, hey, we need this too?
And what did it mean to have Yahweh as their king before they demanded a human king? I mean, that's a huge theological question right there.
Absolutely. It's like they're trading in this direct relationship with God for something, I don't know, maybe a little more tangible, a little more like the nations around them.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like they're trying to fit in, you know, keep up with the Joneses, but on a national level.
Ancient Israel edition.
Exactly. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's rewind back to the beginning. Where does Samuel's story even start?
Well, it starts with his mom, Hannah.
Hannah.
You know, she was barren, which in that time and culture was, well, it was a big deal. It came with a lot of social stigma, not to mention the personal pain and grief.
You can imagine the whispers, the judgments, the pressure she must have felt.
Absolutely. And the lecture really emphasizes, you know, her deep faith. In the midst of all of that, she cries out to God, pours her heart out in prayer, desperate for a son.
And she makes this incredible vow, right? If God gives her a son, she'll dedicate him to God's service.
Yeah. Like, that's a serious level of commitment. I mean, talk about putting your trust in God. You know, it kind of reminds me of those other stories in the Bible where God works through seemingly impossible situations, you know, like Abraham and Sarah. Oh, that's a great comparison. Both couples struggling with infertility, and yet God uses those very struggles to fulfill his promises. It's like, even when things seem hopeless, God's still at work, weaving together his plan.
Exactly. And Hannah's story, it really sets the stage for Samuel's incredible destiny. You know, from the very beginning, he's set apart, consecrated for a special purpose. It's like those echoes you get, I guess you could say, when you read Hannah's song of praise after Samuel's birth.
You mean when she praises God for raising up a king?
Exactly. It foreshadows these themes of power and kingship that we see played out later in the story. I don't know. There's something almost prophetic about it, you know?
It's like those echoes you get, I guess you could say, when you read Hannah's song of praise after Samuel's birth.
Exactly. It foreshadows these themes of power and kingship that we see play out later in the story. I don't know. There's something almost prophetic about it, you know? And it's interesting, you know, when you compare it to Mary's Magnificat much later in the Bible. Both these women celebrating God's power to upend expectations, to lift up the humble.
There are definitely some striking parallels there. Both of them singing about God doing something extraordinary, something unexpected.
And then there's this other fascinating element in Hannah's story, the whole contrast between her and Peninnah.
Oh, yeah. Elkanah's other wife.
Yeah.
The one who could have children.
Exactly. And, you know, that contrast between barrenness and fertility, faithfulness and, well, let's just say lack of faithfulness. It kind of pops up again and again throughout the Book of Samuel, almost like it's, you know, highlighting the choices and the consequences, not just for individuals, but for the whole nation, too.
It's like those contrasts add these layers of meaning, right?
Mm.
They invite us to think about the complexities of those choices, both on a personal level and on this larger national scale.
Exactly. And speaking of complexities, Samuel grows up and he ends up stepping into these like multiple roles, judge, prophet, even kingmaker. I mean, he's considered the last and greatest of the judges, guiding Israel through this incredibly tumultuous period.
And get this, in the Book of Acts, he's even positioned as the head of the prophetic movement. So he's not just a judge. He's like the OG prophet.
Yeah. He's clearly a pivotal figure, someone who bridges these different eras, these different forms of leadership. And like Moses before him, he stands in the gap for the people, pleading with God on their behalf.
But unlike Moses, who primarily received revelation on a mountaintop, Samuel hears God's voice in this quiet, intimate setting of the tabernacle.
Right, yeah. It's a different kind of encounter, a different kind of intimacy with God.
Speaking of the tabernacle, that brings us to another pretty stark contrast. The difference between Samuel growing in godliness and Eli's sons.
Oh boy. Hophni and Phinehas. Let's just say they weren't exactly following in Samuel's footsteps.
They were, well, wicked. And they completely disrespected God's offerings, which is a big no-no in this context.
It really underscores how, even within a family, even within this religious system, there's this huge gulf between those who choose to honor God and those who, well, choose to disregard him.
And it's interesting how the lecture plays with the word great, right? Eli's sons were great in their sin, while Samuel was becoming great in the presence of the Lord.
Yeah, that's a really clever use of language to highlight the contrast. It's a powerful reminder that, you know, true greatness, it's not about worldly standards. It's about faithfulness to God.
It's about aligning yourself with his definition of greatness, not the world's. And as we see throughout the book of Samuel, those choices, they have these ripple effects, consequences that reach far beyond just the individuals involved. But before we dive into all of that, I want to circle back to Samuel's calling as a prophet, because it happens in this really interesting way. The lecture points out that the word of the Lord was rare in those days.
Right. It wasn't like God was speaking to people all the time, you know, through visions and dreams and prophets. It was a much quieter time, spiritually speaking. So when God does speak, it's a big deal.
Yeah, like a spotlight suddenly shining down on this young Samuel.
Imagine he's there at the tabernacle, probably going about his duties, and suddenly he hears a voice calling his name. He thinks it's Eli, but nope.
God's calling out to him directly. Talk about a life-changing moment. But wait, I'm a little confused here. The lecture says that Samuel did not yet know the Lord. What does that mean? I thought he grew up in the tabernacle.
That's a great question. And it can be a bit confusing, right? It doesn't mean he didn't know about God. It's more about experiencing God's presence in this direct, personal way.
Oh, I see.
Like, he hadn't yet learned to discern God's voice in his own life. So this encounter at the tabernacle, it's a turning point for him. It's like he goes from being a dedicated servant to actually becoming a prophet, someone who speaks God's word with authority.
So it's like this transition from hearing about God to actually experiencing God in a real, tangible way.
Exactly. And from that point on, his words carry weight, you know? The lecture says they did not fall to the ground, meaning that people recognize them as coming directly from God.
It's like this shift, not just for Samuel personally, but for the whole nation, too. They're in desperate need of clear guidance, and Samuel becomes that voice.
His first prophecy, though, well, it's not exactly good news. He has to deliver this message of judgment to Eli and his family because of their wickedness.
Oh, man. Talk about a tough first assignment.
Right. It's a turning point, not just for Samuel, but for Eli and his household, too. Their actions have consequences, and those consequences are about to, well, let's just say, they're about to impact the entire nation.
Okay, speaking of consequences, let's talk about the Ark of the Covenant. Because things take a pretty dramatic turn here, right? The Israelites, they're facing this major threat from the Philistines, and they're losing badly.
Yeah, they're in a tough spot. And they decide, you know what? Let's bring the Ark into battle. It'll guarantee us a victory.
It's like they're treating it like some magical good luck charm.
Right, and that's precisely where their understanding goes wrong. The Ark, it wasn't a magical object. It was a symbol of God's presence, and that presence was conditional upon Israel's faithfulness to the covenant.
Oh, that makes sense. It's not about outward rituals or possessing sacred objects. It's about the heart, about genuine obedience to God's law.
Exactly. They were trying to manipulate God into giving them what they wanted. But true power, it doesn't come from manipulating symbols. It comes from aligning ourselves with God's will.
And as you might guess, this whole plan backfires spectacularly.
Big time. The Philistines capture the Ark. It's a devastating blow to the Israelites. Like, the heart of their faith has been ripped out.
They put their trust in the wrong thing, and now they're facing the consequences. I mean, the lecture really emphasizes the repetition of the phrase, the Ark of God was captured.
Oh, yeah, it's repeated over and over again. Like, it's hammering home the weight of this event, you know, this sense of loss and vulnerability it created.
But it's interesting, even in this moment of defeat, God is still at work. The Philistines, thinking they've defeated the God of Israel, take the Ark to the temple of their god Dagon as a trophy.
Oh, yeah, like, look what we conquered. But what happens next is both kind of funny and really profound. They find Dagon fallen on his face before the Ark. At first they think, oh, it must have been an accident. So they prop him back up.
Right, like nothing to see here, folks.
Exactly. But the next day, he's fallen again. And this time, he's headless and handless.
It's like a cosmic slapstick routine. But there's this clever wordplay going on too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Dagon's broken hand contrasted with the heavy hand of the Lord, which brings plagues upon the Philistines. They might have captured the Ark, but they haven't captured God's power.
It's like God sending them a message loud and clear, don't mess with me.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not about military might or outward symbols. True power resides in obedience to the one true God, and the Philistines are about to learn that lesson the hard way.
So the Philistines are freaking out, right? Plagues, their God falling apart. What do they do next?
Well, they eventually decide to send the Ark back to Israel. But even then, they're not, like, fully convinced it's Yahweh who's behind all the chaos.
Oh, really? So, but, like, they still think it's just bad luck or something?
Yeah, there's still some doubt, you know? So they come up with this this elaborate test.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What kind of test?
They hitch the Ark to a cart, right? Pulled by cows. But not just any cows, cows that have just given birth.
Okay, so brand new moms.
Yep. And these cows, they've never been yoked before. So they've never pulled a cart.
Hold on a second. Cows in a cart. This is their big test. It seems a little, I don't know, random.
Well, their logic was, you know, these cows, they're going to naturally want to go back to their calves, right? It's instinct.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So they figure, okay, if these cows, instead of going back to their babies, they head straight back to Israelite territory.
Then it's a sign from God.
Exactly. Like, okay, Yahweh, if this is really you, prove it. Show us a sign.
And what happens? Do the cows pass the test?
They do. The cows, ignoring all their maternal instincts, they walk straight back to Israel. And get this, they're lowing the whole way, like mooing their little hearts out.
It's like a divine GPS, moving right along.
Right. It's this amazing moment where humor and this profound display of God's power, they just, like, collide.
Yeah.
It's making it clear, you know? He's not going to be manipulated and tested. He'll make himself known on his own terms.
Even the cows are like, yep, this is definitely God. So the Ark is back in Israel. What happens next?
Well, a narrative jumps forward about 20 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Big time jump.
Yeah. And Samuel, he's firmly established as a leader now. And the Philistines, they're still a threat, you know? But this time, things are different.
How so? What changes?
Samuel calls on the Israelites to repent, to turn back to the Lord with all their hearts, get rid of those foreign gods.
So it's like a call to renewal, to get back to the basics, to the covenant.
Exactly. And this time, they actually listen. They fast. They confess their sins. Samuel offers sacrifices, praise to the Lord.
So there's this sense of unity, a recommitment to God.
Yeah, totally. And that makes all the difference. Because when the Philistines attack again, the Lord answers Samuel's prayer. Big time.
What happens? Does he send down fire from heaven? Part the Red Sea again?
This time, it's a thunderstorm. A massive, earth-shaking thunderstorm. It throws the Philistines into complete chaos, and the Israelites, they win a decisive victory. It's a total turnaround from their defeat in chapter 4, you know, when they tried to use the Ark as a shortcut to victory.
So it's like they've finally learned their lesson. That true victory comes from aligning themselves with God's will, not from manipulating religious symbols or relying on military might.
Exactly. It's about humility, obedience, acknowledging that God is the one who gives victory.
It's a powerful reminder that true strength comes from dependence on God. But there's a hint in the lecture that things are about to change again, even with this newfound unity. Remember Hannah's song, where she praises God for raising up a king?
Oh, yeah. I see where you're going with this. It sounds like kingship is about to become a reality for Israel.
It's like it's been foreshadowed from the very beginning. But this transition from a theocracy where God is directly ruling them to having a human king, that's a huge shift. And I bet it comes with a whole lot of questions and challenges.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the lecture points out that the Israelites, even after this victory, they start looking around at other nations, seeing these powerful kings,
yeah.
And they start wanting that for themselves.
It's like, hey, we want a king too. Everyone else has one. It's the classic Keeping Up with the Joneses syndrome, ancient Israel edition.
Right. They're seeing everyone else with the latest political fashion, and they want to fit in. But, you know, their demand for a king, it wasn't exactly a sign of their deep faith. It was actually kind of a rejection of God as their king.
It's like they're saying, God, we appreciate you and all, but we'd rather have someone a little more, you know, visible, a little more like the kings we see around us.
Exactly. They're looking for a human leader. Someone who can lead armies, consolidate power, just like the kings of the surrounding nations. But the thing is, up until this point, Yahweh was their king. He was directly guiding and protecting them.
So they're essentially trading in this direct relationship with God for something. I don't know, maybe a little more tangible, a little more human.
Yeah.
But the lecture says that God allows this, even though their motives were, well, let's be honest, a little off.
Right. Because God can work through even our flawed desires to accomplish his purposes. He's not limited by our short-sightedness.
So even though they're asking for a king for all the wrong reasons, God can still use the situation to further his plan.
Exactly. And this is where it gets really fascinating. It's like God is saying, all right, you want a king, I'll give you a king, but let me show you what you're really asking for.
Uh-oh. I have a feeling this isn't going to end well.
And that's where Samuel's warning comes in. He delivers this message from God, and it's not exactly a glowing endorsement of kingship.
He lays down the law, literally, about what a king, like the ones Israel admires, would actually do. And I'm guessing it's not pretty.
Not at all. Samuel's warning in 1 Samuel 8 paints a pretty bleak picture of life under a human king. He uses the word take over and over again. It's like he's emphasizing how this king would take their sons for his army, take their daughters for his service, take their fields, their crops, their livestock. It's a stark warning about the potential for abuse of power when human rulers are given unchecked authority.
Wow, it's like God is giving them a glimpse behind the curtain, showing them the potential downsides of what they're asking for. But did they listen?
Well, you probably already know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. They were so fixated on this idea of being like all the other nations that they completely missed the point. They wanted a king, and that was that.
They seemed pretty determined to learn this lesson the hard way. So who does God choose for this whole king-sized experiment?
Enter Saul. Tall, handsome Benjamite from a wealthy family. He literally stumbles into his destiny. He's out searching for his father's lost donkeys when he ends up consulting Samuel, who's already been told by God to anoint the next king.
It's amazing how these seemingly random encounters can change the course of history. So Samuel anoints Saul, and boom, he's king. Just like that.
Well, there's a private anointing by Samuel, like a behind-the-scenes confirmation of God's choice. But then there's a public selection at Mizpah. Saul's chosen by lot, which makes it clear this isn't just Samuel's decision, it's God's will.
Okay, so it's a combo of divine appointment and public affirmation. Got it. So Saul is the chosen one, but does he live up to the hype?
Well, his first test comes when the Ammonites threaten Jabesh-Gilead. Saul rallies the troops. They win a decisive victory. Everyone's ecstatic. It seems like he's off to a great start. But the lecture really stresses this crucial idea of kingship under covenant. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means that even though Israel now has a human king, he's not above the law. He's not like the kings of surrounding nations, where their word was law. Saul's role is to lead within the framework of the covenant, not to replace it or rewrite it.
Exactly. He's accountable to God's law, just like everyone else in Israel. And that's a crucial distinction, one that sets Israelite kingship apart from all the other nations. It's meant to reflect God's character, his desire for justice and righteousness.
So it's not just about having a king. It's about having a king who understands that true authority comes from God and that he's called to lead with humility and obedience. That adds a whole other layer of complexity to this kingship thing.
And that complexity, that tension between human leadership and divine authority, that's what makes it so fascinating. You have to consider the historical context, the political realities, and the theological implications. It's all intertwined.
Plus, you've got the human element. Flawed motives, power struggles, it's all there in the story. So where do we go from here? What happens next in this epic saga of Saul and his kingship? Okay, so you've got King Saul, right, operating under this kingship under covenant system. Sounds like a pretty delicate balance, you know, between human leadership and divine authority. Does he manage to stay on that tightrope, or does he, take a bit of a tumble?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Mm. And the answer, as we see play out in the rest of Saul's reign, it's complicated. There are these moments where he seems to get it, you know, where he acts with humility and obedience to God. But then there are those other times.
Those other times. Okay. What happens during those? What kind of trouble does Saul get himself into?
One example that really stands out is this incident with the Philistines in 1 Samuel 13. The Israelites, they're facing off against their old enemies, and Saul's starting to get a little anxious.
I can imagine. The pressure must have been intense. Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's got this army to lead, the enemy's closing in, and Samuel, who's supposed to arrive and offer sacrifices before the battle, well, he's delayed.
Okay, so I'm trying to put myself in Saul's shoes here. He's got this huge responsibility, the fate of the nation resting on his shoulders, and the prophet who's supposed to, you know, get them spiritually prepared is nowhere to be found. I see how he might start to feel, well, a little panicked.
Exactly. And that's the point where Saul, he makes a critical mistake. He decides to just take matters into his own hands and offer the sacrifices himself.
Oh, no. Didn't he realize that was a big no-no?
Well, he probably thought he was doing the right thing, you know, trying to keep things moving forward, not let the troops lose heart. But in this context, offering sacrifices, that was a priestly duty. And Saul, as king, he overstepped his bounds.
I'm sensing this wasn't just some minor breach of protocol. What's the deeper significance here? Why was it such a big deal for Saul to offer those sacrifices?
It all boils down to understanding the limits of authority, even for a king. Saul's action, it kind of reveals that he's not fully grasping this concept of kingship under covenant.
Yeah.
He's trying to, you know, usurp a role that isn't his, pattern we see repeat itself throughout his reign.
So even though he's king, he's not above God's law. There are still boundaries he needs to respect. I'm guessing Samuel wasn't too thrilled about this.
You're telling me. When Samuel arrives and finds out what Saul's done, he is furious. He tells Saul, straight up, because of your disobedience, your kingdom will not endure.
Wow, that's a pretty harsh consequence. It seems like a really severe punishment for what might seem, I don't know, like a relatively minor offense.
But it's not just about the act itself. It's about what it reveals about Saul's heart. He's not fully submitting to God's authority. And that lack of submission, that desire to grab power that isn't his, that's ultimately what leads to his downfall.
It's a powerful lesson, and not just for ancient kings, right? It resonates throughout history. Leaders who fail to acknowledge a higher authority, whether it's God or the Constitution, often end up, well, causing their own downfall.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that true power, it comes from aligning yourself with something greater than yourself.
So even though Israel demanded a king, even though God granted their request, he wasn't just going to let Saul run the show however he pleased. God is still the ultimate authority.
And he's using Saul's reign, both the good and the bad, to teach Israel and us some pretty profound lessons about leadership, about obedience, about the true nature of power. It kind of makes you wonder, though, right? If Saul had really understood kingship under covenant, how might things have turned out differently?
It's a good question to think about. And not just for Saul, but for ourselves, too. How often do we try to grab control, do things our own way, even when we know deep down there's a better path? A path of humility, of submission to something greater than ourselves.
It's a lifelong journey, isn't it? Learning to let go of our own agendas, our own desires for control, and surrender to God's will.
This deep dive into the book of Samuel, it's been fascinating. And honestly, a bit unsettling. It's definitely challenged some of my assumptions, not just about leadership and power, but about how God works in the world.
It's a book that keeps on giving, you know, full of these rich insights and timeless truths. There's always something new to discover.
And to all our listeners out there, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We hope it sparks some new insights, some new questions, and maybe even a desire to do some exploring of your own. Because the journey of faith, well, it's a lifelong deep dive. Until next time, happy diving.